Good morning, Nexus, and welcome to another online Sunday morning. I'm thrilled you're with us. And now that we're done the practices, we can move fully into our season theme for the year, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Cosmos for Wandering Hearts, a phrase I borrowed from James K. Smith. But I'm so excited about the coming weeks and months. There's so many areas I want to unpack. Human thriving, what it means to thrive as a human. I've got a lot of narrative sermons in sort of the hopper ready to go that I'm excited about. And I want to continue also deconstruction and facing more of our doubts and what that means. And I want to talk about this imminent frame. There's so many things that I want to explore. I want to get to Jesus' ascension, which has been an area of doubt for me for a long time. The book of Revelation, which I'm like, what is up with that? I really want to get there and unpack that as well. So there's so many ideas that I'm working through, and I'm just, I'm excited to get going. But for this morning, I want to introduce you to a man named John von Neumann. Now, he was one of the greatest mathematical and strategic minds of the 20th century. I mean, his resume is impressive. He had this gift for applied mathematics, and his work has influenced so many different fields like quantum theory, economics, evolutionary biology, military defense planning. I mean, von Neumann was part of the Manhattan Project. His work ended up influencing the outcome of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And on top of that, he was one of the conceptual inventors of the computer. I mean, this guy had a storied career, but my interest in him doesn't come from any of those remarkable achievements of him. My interest in him is that he was the father of something called game theory. Now, what is game theory? Well, it's simply this. Game theory is a theoretical framework for conceiving social situations among competing players. Game theory is the science of strategy, or at least the optimal decision-making of an independent and competing actors in a strategic setting. Now, his book, Theory of Games and Economic Behavior, it's like the foundational text of game theory. And today, his applications, again, from this theory, they've affected so many fields: social science, logic, system science, computer science. And it's also led to a lot of national defense strategies, like pursuing a nuclear policy of mutually assured destruction. That was von Neumann's idea. But here's the thing. The entire theory was inspired by one single game. Poker. You see, for von Neumann and many others, there's no other game that mimics life quite as well as poker does. I mean, consider the nature of games. Consider the nature of most casino games or board games, right? They're games with dice, slot machines. Most of them are games of pure chance. To win, you need a whole lot of luck. But on the flip side, you have games like chess, which are games that can be mastered because all the information is contained. And so in chess, every move can be sort of mathematically accounted for in advance. And so for von Neumann and others, poker represents this perfect medium, you could say, this indescribable balance between skill and chance. And the reason they thought it mimicked life is because skill and chance make up so much of our lives. You see, apparently, von Neumann was an awful poker player, but he believed and theorized that if he could figure out the game, he would hold the solution to some of life's greatest decision-making challenges. I mean, consider Maria Konnikova. She's fantastic. A woman who got into poker, went on to win a World Series tournament, a game that's dominated by men, and she's written a book about it, and she's just a fabulous, interesting character. But she says this about poker. Poker, unlike quite any other game, mirrors life. It isn't the roulette wheel of pure chance, nor is it the chess of mathematical elegance and perfect information. Like the world we inhabit, it consists of an inextricable joining of the two. Poker stands at the fulcrum that balances two oppositional forces in our lives, chance and control. Anyone can get lucky or unlucky at a single hand, a single game, a single tournament. One turn and you're on top of the world. Another, you're cast out, no matter your skill, training, preparation, or aptitude. In the end, though, luck is a short-term friend or foe. Skill shines through over the long-time horizon. And you see, this is what makes poker, if you've ever played it, at times it can be absolutely infuriating, and the next moment it can be ecstasy provoking. You see, you can win at poker with the worst hand, and you can lose with the best hand. You know, in every other game, like casino games or video games or, you know, perfect games like chess, you simply have to be the best or you have to get good luck. Do the best or have the best to win, but not so with poker and not so with life. I mean, consider this. The economist Ingo Fielder, he analyzed hundreds of thousands of hands played on several online poker sites over a six-month period. And the actual hand that was the best won, on average, he found only 12% of the time. And less than a third of all hands went to an actual showdown. This, in a nutshell, is why poker is a skilled endeavor rather than a gambling one, and it's why it mimics life so perfectly. So, let's play a little poker, shall we? Now, I've already shuffled these, but I'll give it one more shuffle. Now, I'm sure you don't trust me, but let's say we're playing against each other. Heads up, I'm gonna deal you two cards, myself two cards. If you don't know how to play poker, you'll figure it out. Now, I'm gonna turn my head here. I'm gonna show you your two cards there. Hopefully the camera picks that up, you can see. All right, let's play. I got mine. Interesting. So let's play a little hand. You've got your cards, you've got mine. Do you wanna fold? Let's see. Turn and burn a card, let's see. Three of spades, four of hearts, nine of spades. What do you wanna do? You wanna stay in the game? Now we can't do money right now, but you know what? I'll check. What do you think? You're gonna check as well, fair enough. Here we go, next card, turn and burn. Eight of spades. All right, now we got flush potential on the board. I'm gonna bet a little imaginary, okay? You're gonna do the same. Turn and burn, seven. Seven of hearts. Now, I'm not playing for money at the moment, so I'm gonna go ahead and reveal that I got king 10. That's not good. All I've got is a high card. What did you get? Six, seven. Look at that. You took it on the river there. You've got a pair. You won. How about that? Good for you. Now, of course, we played just a little silly game there. Nice win on your part. But of course, we missed one of the very crucial elements of the game of poker, the betting, the money. You see, what we've performed here is just the equivalent of a tabletop game, you could say. Konnikova says this: tabletop games are fun because we can step inside a magic circle of play and commit fully without having to live with the consequences. Now, of course, this is what makes games fun, right? No consequences. You can play Monopoly, or you can be playing video games, playing Zelda Breath of the Wild or Settlers of Catan or whatever your favorite game is. The reason that it's fun, of course, is because there's no consequences. You lose all your property in Monopoly, you lose Settlers, you die in Zelda, no consequences to you. And this is why, of course, when we play games, some of us, certainly not me, but some of us can be kind of brats because there's no consequences to our play. It's just a game. But this is the thing about poker, it's different. When you play poker, you have to live with the real consequences for the decisions that you make. And I would say this, the unfortunate thing today is that I think many of us live a lot of our lives actually as if we are playing tabletop games where we don't have to live with the consequences. You could call this tabletop values, right? A belief, conviction, opinion, or value we have that has no consequence for us and doesn't cost us anything. Let me give you a couple quick illustrations of this. First, I tend to believe, hold the conviction, that we need more affordable housing. Moreover, I'm also of the opinion that housing developers today in KW should have to include affordable housing units in any new builds that they do. That's a belief of mine, a conviction. Fair enough. But here's the thing. It's merely a tabletop belief. Why is that? Well, I'm not a developer. Moreover, I don't currently live in a neighborhood that is proposing affordable housing units. So this belief of mine is tabletop. It has no consequence for me, and it doesn't cost me anything to hold it. Or second, think about it this way. I also believe that cities should have safe consumption or injection sites. Now, I think in my head, that's a good policy. But here's the thing again. I don't live in a place where a site has been proposed in my neighborhood, and so I don't have skin in the game. You know, my belief that we need safe consumption and injection sites, it doesn't cost me anything. And so it has no real consequence for me. It's a tabletop belief. Or think about this in terms of church and faith, right? If my faith has no consequence or cost to the way that I live my life, well, then what I have is really just tabletop Christianity. Or if I believe church is important, but I don't give to it financially, if I don't volunteer my time, if I don't sacrifice money, energy, availability, then my belief in church, well, it's nothing more than tabletop. For a belief, conviction, opinion, or value to have any integrity, it must cost us something and come with consequences. We must have skin in the game. This is the core of poker. You see, when you're playing poker, the question you have to ask yourself every time you have a hand is, how much do I actually believe in these cards that I'm holding? Do I believe in them enough to actually make a bet? You see, anyone can hold a pair of cards or anyone can hold a set of convictions if it doesn't cost you something. But the game of poker, and I would say the game of life, so to speak, it won't allow for it. And I would submit the Christian path won't either. I mean, consider Immanuel Kant in his book, Critique of Pure Reason, this German philosopher. He proposes betting as an antidote to one of the great ills of society. This is what he says. It frequently happens that a man delivers his opinions with such boldness and assurance that he appears to be under no apprehension as to the possibility of his being in error. The offer of a bet startles him. Now that he has something real at stake, he has to reevaluate just how sure of a sure thing his opinion really is. I mean, consider it this way. If you can, I want you to imagine where you were headwise, the mindset you were in on the morning of November 8th, 2016. Now, that was the day the election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And if you're anything like me, you woke up that morning expecting that by the end of the evening, Hillary Clinton would have won the US election over Donald Trump. In fact, here's the thing. If somebody had asked me that morning if I wanted to place a $100 bet on my opinion that Hillary would win, I probably would have taken it without hesitation. And I wasn't alone. Every media source had polls showing Hillary Clinton winning. And every media source was wrong. I mean, consider the pollster Nate Silver. He had done such a fantastic job forecasting past elections that people were shocked when his projection turned out to be wrong. But let's consider for a moment what Nate Silver actually said on the morning of November 8th, 2016. In his final poll released that morning, he gave Hillary Clinton a 71% chance of winning and Donald Trump a 29% chance of winning. 29%. That's actually pretty good. That's a whole lot of percent. That's nearly a third. And yet most people, myself including, we saw that 71% and we read it as certain, right? To the vast majority, 71% is synonymous with winning. I would have bet on that $100 without thinking twice. But when you think about it in poker terms, things change a little. I mean, what would it look like to be playing cards with a 71% chance of winning versus a 29% chance of winning? Well, that's like Hillary Clinton playing pocket nines versus Donald Trump playing ace seven. Suddenly things are a little different for me. I'm not so sure I'm willing to bet big on pocket nines when this one has an ace in its corner. You see, this is the interesting thing. Nate Silver is actually a poker player. Once upon a time, he actually made a decent living playing online poker. And poker taught him something fundamental about the nature of our world that some of us, we never really bother to grasp. Poker is such a powerful window into the nature of our world, into the nature of life, not in spite of the betting, but because of the betting. It says, Konnikova says, the betting in poker isn't incidental. It's integral to the learning process. Our minds learn when we have a stake, a real stake in the outcome of our learning. You see, what poker does is it asks us to take something valuable and put it on the line in order to play. And this is why it mirrors life so well. I would also say this is why poker mirrors the life of faith as well, because in life, in faith, you have to have skin in the game in order to hold on to your integrity. For a belief, conviction, opinion, or value to have any integrity, it must cost us something and come with consequences. We must have skin in the game. And sure, there are times when we can go all in and lose it all. You could be playing your pocket nines and boom, there's an ace. Suddenly your 71% chance of winning doesn't look so great. And that's the nature, the lesson of both poker, life, and faith. There are no certainties. There are no guarantees. Life, faith, poker, risk is inherent to all of them. But having a stake in what matters to us, having skin in the actual game for what we hold to be true and important, that is essential. Because without it, we aren't truly committed. We don't have to live with the consequences of our beliefs, our actions, or our opinions. Nassim Taleb, he's this just really harsh, interesting fella, but he can be brutal sometimes. And he wrote a book called Skin in the Game. And he expounds on this idea at length. And he arrives, interestingly enough, at a theological conclusion, even though that's not obvious throughout the book. But in it, he raves endlessly about those in the financial markets, for instance, right, who take other people's money. They make huge profits on them if they succeed, but they end up being bailed out by taxpayers if they fail. And so in reflecting on the financial crash of 2008, Taleb laments that the banks were deemed too big to fail. And for Taleb, it's like this is an unjust equation because profits are privatized, but losses become socialized. He lambasts a man like Bob Rubin, right? This guy was CEO of Citibank who received $120 million in compensation from the bank before the crash. And yet, when the bank went bankrupt, he suffered absolutely no consequences for the decisions he made that led to the company's downfall. Rubin, according to Taleb, had no skin in the game. And this is at the root of so many injustices in our world. People who can make decisions, people who can make policy without skin in the game. But what really caught my attention about Taleb was this line. He says this, "No one should be too big to fail, not even God." And it's interesting in reading Taleb because he says this line of thinking was the first time that he truly understood the nature of the Trinity and why the incarnation was so necessary. Having skin in the game is precisely the point of Jesus' incarnation. When John tells us in his gospel that the Word became flesh, it's essentially like God going all in on the poker table. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all humankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. God becomes human to have skin in the game. Quite literally, the word incarnation actually means flesh. It's putting your flesh, your skin in the game. It means this, that not even God is separated from his, her actions. And this is why it seems like this sort of remote belief with no consequences, but this is why the Jesus path asks us to trust in the dual nature of Jesus, that Jesus was both fully divine and fully human. And why is it important to trust that? It seems like such a trivial thing. The reason we're asked to trust this is because in the incarnation, God takes on flesh. God has skin in the game. God has put some chips in the pot. Taleb's line of thinking is simply this. If God is going to ask us to live in a certain way and trust that certain things are true, well, then it's not good enough for God to simply ask that of us without having skin in the game. And that's what happens incarnation, in Jesus, God has flesh in the game. God has a stake in the outcome. God has gone all in, you could say, and in doing so, we trust that God in Jesus actually suffers on the cross, sacrifices himself, and experiences death. You see, a God stripped of humanity can't have skin in the game, because a God like that can't really suffer. Via the incarnation, God announces all in. God announces, I've got skin in the game. And in having skin in the game, Jesus asks the same of us. I mean, consider one of Jesus' perhaps most harsh parables. I mean, on the page, it just reads like cruel, brutal. But Jesus was a fan of using hyperbolic language to get his message across, right? Like, you've got to sometimes push the envelope in order for people to catch on and wake up. And one of these parables he tells is the parable of the talents. And I think its message is a little harsh, but challenging and necessary. Here's how the story goes down. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To the one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. Now the man who had received 5 bags of gold went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more. Put his money to work sounds like gambling to me. But so also the one with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more. Interesting. A lot of people playing poker. But the man who had received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. Now, after a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received 5 bags of gold brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 bags of gold. See, I put it down on the poker table, I've gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man with the 2 bags of gold also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 bags of gold. See, I've gained 2 more. Master replied again, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received 1 bag of gold came. Master, he said, I know that you're a hard man. You harvest where you've not sown. You gather where you've not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and I went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew, did you, that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with a banker so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest at least. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Whoa, that gets a little intense there at the end. Like, my goodness, that seems cruel. I mean, he didn't lose the money. I mean, it's still there. But it's like, wow, what is going on? And, you know, there's a lot of different interpretations of this parable. Some people thinking, you know what, Jesus is the anti-master, right? Not harsh like that, but I think at least face value, there's still something here, because what is going on with this hyperbolic and harsh sounding story? And what I would say is this, I would submit to you that what Jesus is doing is just in a dramatic way, reinforcing the point I'm making here, that we need to have skin in the game. If you don't take a risk, if you never put yourself on the line, if you never actually invest with what you have or invest in what is important, well, you're kind of useless. Consider Nassim Taleb again. He says this, skin in the game is mostly about justice, honor, and sacrifice, things that are existential for humans. Life is sacrifice and risk-taking, and nothing that doesn't entail some moderate amount of sacrifice and risk is close to what we can call life. Love without sacrifice is theft. This applies to any form of love, particularly the love of God. If we don't have skin in the game for the things that we say we value, for the things we say we believe or hold to be true and important, well, in a certain sense, we lack integrity. I mean, consider this idea. I mean, love without sacrifice is theft. theft. Consider one of the oldest rituals. It dates back even before Roman times, but it was sort of cemented then, the engagement ring, right? Unbelievable. This idea that when you want to marry someone, you give them an engagement ring. And it's kind of an odd little ritual, but again, it dates back thousands of years. Ring to ask somebody to marry them. Now, why do we do that? I mean, I consider my own engagement story. When I was ready to ask Kristen to marry me, I was just broke. I was like 23, I think it was. I didn't have a penny to my name. In fact, I was quite in debt at the time, school debt, whatnot. But I knew I wanted to ask her to marry me. And, you know, it was like, what am I going to do? Well, I had been in a band back in the day. And, you know, when I was in my teens, I bought this PA system, right? So I could sing. I bought this PA system. It was worth $5,000. And remember, I'm like, I don't have any money to get her engagement ring. And I was thinking, what am I going to do? And I finally arrived at the conclusion, I've got to sell my PA system. And I hated the idea of it. I remember going to The Beat Goes On. I sold like a ton of CDs, right? But only ended up with like $30. So I'm like, I got to sell the PA system. I got to do it. So I walk into this pawn shop. I lay it out. They test it out. I'm like, what will you give me for this? And I remember they were like, looked it over. They're like, we'll give you $1,200. I'm like, oh, are you serious? Come on. This is in great condition. I bought it for $5,000. Come on. Really? Just $1,200? I was like, what about 15? Would you give me 1500 for it? And they're like, fine, 1500. And I remember in my head thinking, shoot, I should have shot higher, 2000. But we settled on 1500 for my PA system. I've got 1500. And I remember I got that 1500 and I walk into, I think it was People's Jeweler in Fairview Mall. And I'm looking around at these engagement rings and I look down and I find the perfect. And it's just so gorgeous. I'm like, this is the ring. And so I get it out. I'm taking a look at it. And I'm like, so how much is this ring? And the person said to me, well, that's $12,000. And I said, you know, I'm gonna have to think about this. And, you know, trying to save face. So I gave it back. I said, I might be back. I got to think about this. And I left and immediately went down the mall, down to the other jewelry store. And I started like, can we look at the rings around $1,000? And, you know, finally I landed on one, asked Kristen to marry me. Obviously she said yes, but what's the deal with that? I mean, why can't you just ask someone, hey, will you marry me? What's the idea here? The ring that we give someone dating back thousands of years is the idea of putting skin in the game. It's like sometimes words aren't quite enough. Sometimes what we want to know is that people actually have skin in the game. And the engagement ring is an ancient tradition, an ancient ritual that says, I've put money on the line. I've put an investment into this. I'm not just telling you I love you and want to spend the rest of my life with you. I've got skin in the game. And what's it, 17 years later, best investment I ever made in my life. Love you, Kristen. Fantastic investment. Paying off in dividends, I would say. But that's the idea behind the engagement ring. Skin in the game. And this is what God, via the incarnation, demonstrates for us. On a cosmic scale, God has announced she's willing to go all in. Go all in. Put everything on the line to show us love, forgiveness, and the possibility of a new way of living. Skin in the game, and God goes all in. And Jesus now calls us to do the same. If you don't have skin in the game, whatever game that is, we are the cowards of the parable who sit around, do nothing, burying what we do have because we aren't willing to take the risk of losing something. If you're not willing to fail, if you're not willing to risk or sacrifice, you're not willing to love. Let me lay out for you some implications of this. Like, okay, Brad, life is like a game of poker. You got to go in sometimes. What does this mean? What are the implications for us? Well, let me lay out a few. The first is simply a question. What are you willing to fail for in life? In poker, this is the fundamental question with each hand, with every two cards that you are dealt. This is the question. Do I like these cards enough to play them?
Do I like these cards enough to actually put some skin in the game, to put some chips into the pot? In poker, right, if you get dealt a pair of aces, that's like the best hand. You always play them. You're always willing to bet on those. And yes, sometimes you can fail. Sometimes something happens. It doesn't work out. But when you find those hands, those pocket aces, whatever it is, you always play them. And I would say this, it's the same in life. Ask yourself, what are you willing to fail for in life? What are your pocket aces, you could say? And if you can answer that question, this thing is my pocket aces in life, well, then you've probably found your passion and your calling. If you love that thing, whatever it is, enough to risk failure for, you found, I would say, your divine calling. Pay attention to that. And if you can name it, then ask yourself, well, do I have skin in the game for this thing? Or is it remaining like that talent? Is it a treasure of yours that you've simply buried in the ground? I think it all starts for many of us asking, what are we willing to fail for? What other implications can we glean from this, right? Poker, faith, what can we glean from this? Well, this idea of skin in the game, Nassim Taleb has a whole bunch of Talibisms, I like to call them. And again, this guy's kind of brutal, right? Like he's just in your face. He's always in confrontations on Twitter and with other people. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But some of these I think are interesting, and at least that they challenge us to think hard about what we actually believe. I mean, consider this Talibism. If you do not take risks for your opinion, you are nothing. Ouch. A little bit harsh, but there's a kernel of truth there. If you've got a lot of opinions but never risk anything for it, well, what are you? Or consider this. He says this. If you can't put your soul into something, give it up and leave that stuff to someone else. I think that's a great piece of advice because we're so pressured all the time these days, right, to get involved with everything. But the reality is this, you can't be passionately involved in every cause, in every good deed. It's simply not possible for us. And when we get stretched thin like that, it's like playing a poker. They've got a term in poker, it's called limping in. And that means that you're carrying just basically decent cards and you're willing to pay the minimum bet in order to see the flop and hope that you get lucky. But I've got a friend, right, who says, when you see people limping in poker, it's the smell of weakness because they don't actually believe in their cards. They don't actually think that they have a chance of winning. They're just hoping to get lucky. And a lot of us move through life that way going, I don't know if I actually believe in this cause, or I don't know if I actually am that passionate about it. And yet we feel guilted and pressured to participate in everything. And what Taleb is saying here is, listen, if you can't love it, if you're not willing to risk yourself for it, sacrifice for it, then just give it up and leave it to someone else. We don't have to do everything. Or consider his advice to young people who are looking to change the world. I think this is fantastic, even if maybe not true all of the time, but I love what he says here. Taleb says this, when young people who want to help humankind come to me asking, what should I do? I want to reduce poverty, save the world, and similar noble aspirations at the macro level, my suggestion is this. First, never engage in virtue signaling. Second, never engage in rent seeking, which is influencing public policy for increasing profits. But third, you must start a business. Put yourself on the line and start a business. Yes, take risk. And if you get rich, which is optional, spend your money generously on others. Courage, risk-taking, is the highest virtue. It is the only virtue that cannot be faked. Wow, that's challenging, but it's also true. I love that. I had never thought about that before, but he's right. Courage is the only virtue that cannot be faked. And if you want to go in on something, if you're really passionate about changing the world, then put yourself on the line, he says. Start a business where, well, the consequences are steep for you. Put yourself fully in. Go all in on it. It's scary, but the best things in life, the most true things in life, things like love are worth sacrificing. They're worth risking over. What about the implications for like a faith community like ours? For Nexus, what does this mean? Well, let me just say it plain and straight. We need more people here with skin in the game at Nexus. I know that sounds big, but I just want to be straightforward. For a community like this, we need people to be invested. We need people to have a stake in whether or not this thing works. We need people who are going to have skin in the game. And you know, one of the things that just always makes me grateful is the amount of people who already are heavily invested in Nexus through their finances, the time they give, the energy that they give. We have a lot of people here at Nexus with skin in the game. And to those people, I say thank you. Thank you for putting your chips in the pot, taking a risk, willing to live with the consequences. Thank you. We need that for a community like ours to thrive and function. But I'd also use this as an invitation. If you're on the line, you're like, I don't know, should I invest in this? My encouragement would be to you would be this. Put some skin in the game here. Put some skin in the game. Invest yourself. Root yourself. And you know, I know some people will say, man, I've been hurt by church. I don't know. I'm on the line here. I don't know if I want to give myself completely over to this community. Let's say, listen, I get that. You know, one of the things I'm convinced of is this: scars signal skin in the game. You know, the reality is the scars that we carry in life, whether they're physical or emotional, whatever they are, scars are a reminder that we have put skin in the game. And if poker teaches you anything, it's that life is full of tough, bad beats. I remember playing with a group of friends and I was so excited. I was dealt pocket kings. And the flop comes out and it was 5-5 king. Oh my goodness, on the flop, I had a full house. Kings over fives. I was so excited. And so I try, you know, I want to make some good decisions here. So I played it well. And then the flop came and I'm still holding king full house, kings over fives. And so I go all in my little $5, play $5 games. I went all in. I'm thinking, somebody take this bet. And sure enough, someone else goes all in and they flip over a pair of fives. And a four of a kind to my full house, and I lost my $5. And I was so deflated, like, oh, come on, I had it. I was so sure I had it. And you talk to anyone who's played poker even just once, and they were guaranteed to tell you their story of bad beats. You go in with a full house only to lose to four of a kind. It hurts. It stings. Poker, life, there are times where we get beat up. There are times where we go all in and lose it all. And we carry scars from that, right? In life, in church. We carry the scars and wounds of those, but that simply means we already have skin in the game. If you've been hurt, if you've been scarred by church in the past, that means you've already got skin in the game. You're already invested. And so my encouragement to you would be this: don't be scared to go back in. Don't be scared to invest and commit yourself and put some skin in the game here at Nexus. Because the truth is, any poker player will tell you, yes, bad beats happen, but you can't let those temporary setbacks. Make sure you're making wise decisions and keep pushing forward. Life, faith, is full of chance. It's full of risk, and we will get burned. But you keep playing. Unless you're a gambling addict, in which case you should not. But in the larger metaphor here, you keep playing, you keep plugging away. And so as we sort of head into the theme of this year, let me invite you to put some skin in the game here at Nexus. Invest yourself. We need you here at Nexus. Whether that's financially, we rarely ask for financial contributions. I haven't done that in a while online, but our financial contributions from people who are putting skin in the game here at Nexus. It keeps us running. It keeps us moving. And so we thank you for those who have given and asked, hey, if you're following along with us, if you feel yourself that this community is important, that the work we're doing matters, we would ask you to give. And not just financially, but your time, your energy. Invest in Nexus and know that we know the risks here. We know that you've been burned. Some of us have been burned before, but such is life. Love without sacrifice is theft. Hope that you will join us on the journey for the rest of the season. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Thank you for putting some skin in the game by investing your time and energy with us. I appreciate it greatly. For the rest of this week, go in peace.